everybody. Welcome to the Alexi Sell podcast number 16. And we are sitting here in my flat awaiting the arrival of Jeremy Corbyn, who is going to be our guest today on... I don't know. I was going to... First of all, I thought it was going to be like, you know, the A to Z of politics, and he could do democratic socialism, D. You know, normally we just talk to academics about anarchism or Bolshevism or communism, but actually Jeremy Corbyn is actually somebody who's not just got an academic interest, but came very close to instituting the political philosophy that he espouses. But I think it'll just be... I think it dilutes the podcast just to make it part of the A to Z. I think it's just, it's all Jeremy all the time. JC, all JZ all the time podcast.
Okay,
nothing else, nothing more. No fan art, no Lego figures, no bike rides, no... No,
all right,
no, we'll shit like that.
Get to that next week then.
Yeah.
I say next week. It's been a while.
Yeah,
hello,
been a
listeners.
While. Yeah.
Every little movement outside the window, I twitch and see if that's
yeah,
him.
Yeah, we're like nervous brides waiting for the Rolls Royce to turn up. Hey? No.
Linda's here in the background.
Wilf's here. Everybody's
here. Whole entourage.
Yeah, the whole
sale. What are you hoping this will be like to cover today?
Yeah, that's an interesting... I think, yeah, I mean, obviously we'll talk about politics and political positions and theories, but I just think that this is a man who has been through an experience that nobody else on the planet has really been through. Mm. And if he can reflect on that, I'm not saying that he will be able to or willing to, but if he is able and willing to reflect on that, I think that would be extraordinary, because he's never been allowed the space to do that, really. And also this, we are on the eve of the Labour Party conference, a conference in which... Keir Starmer is going to attempt to enact all kinds of right-wing policies that will eternally lock the entire left out of any possibility of political power, really.
He's trying to change the electoral system.
Oh, he's trying to change the electoral system. He's trying to make everybody wear pointy hats. He's trying to ban, I don't know.
He's trying to get a Coca-Cola sponsorship.
Yeah, he's trying to get sponsored by, Lockheed Martin Defense Systems.
There's a stall sponsored by the Sun, I'm out.
Yeah, there's a stall sponsored by the Sun.
No way.
Fuck's sake. I know, it's extraordinary. All kinds of shit, really. And we are on the very... this is now Thursday, 23rd of September. We are on the edge of that. And, you know, so it's...
And Jeremy's not been allowed to go, right?
No, he is. Well, they can't stop him going.
Oh, okay.
They can't stop. They can't have a roadblock outside Brighton. He's not speaking at the conferences. Well, we can ask him, I suppose. He's speaking at Fringe Meetings, which is the World Transformed, which is the Momentum Festival.
Just got a message. They're 10 minutes away.
10 minutes away.
It is kind of surreal.
Yeah, it's a bit weird.
Come around your house.
I don't know. Yeah,
it's very surreal for me.
Yeah,
I can't believe this is happening, but also no. I can, because we've done quite a lot with this show. We've created some pretty magical moments.
Yeah.
And if he's to show up on any podcast, why the fuck not the Alexi Sell podcast?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, we're hoping, aren't we? We both have this kind of fantasy that he's going to say something, that this is going to break really big and we're going to get like 2 million...
headlines,
yeah. Yeah, 2 million listens, and this is going to break through, and, you know, the MSM are going to pick it up. And
you got to aim high, come on.
Yeah, well, at least in our fantasies, there's probably none of that is going to happen, but, you know...
All right.
I think that's our joint dream.
I can't help but have this nagging feeling in the back of my head that I'm slightly out of my depth. So any advice or more, any rules for me?
No, don't. Any rules? No, don't.
Can I ask him if he's ever played Dungeons and Dragons? That's the only question I want to ask.
Really?
Well, maybe towards the end when we've run out of geopolitical matters about how we bring socialism and fairness to the dispossessed of the world, you can ask him about fucking Dungeons and Dragons. Maybe, maybe not until then.
That's him.
Yeah, you get it. Yeah. So you get that, or you go to the door. Hey, Carrie.
Good to see you.
Yeah. Oh, right. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm slightly overexcited.
Well,
I've hidden the Jeremy Corbyn books.
There are some cables
here. I'm not kidding.
You want to see your
I'm not kidding.
Yeah, don't worry. Whatever you want, really. I mean, you know.
Of course, you're welcome to join us now. Or do you want something to drink?
Yeah. Your coffee, Alexi.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Black or white?
White. Just a hint of milk, comrade.
Yes, please.
Sure. We need another couple of cups, I think.
Jeremy, welcome to Doughty Street. Thank you very much for coming.
I've dressed for radio, as you
can see. I remember when I went to a meeting when you launched the 2019, and Diane Abbott, who obviously knows you well, spoke, and she said when she met you, you bought all your clothes from the co-op.
Yeah.
Is that...
She often made... any unkind comments about my clothes. You know.
Did you get your hair cut by the council as well? Is that... get your hair cut by his
council? Haircut, co-op clothes, yeah, absolutely. But then it got worse that I was voted the worst-dressed MP in Parliament by a secret panel. I got this several years running, and the late, great Tony Banks said... Corbyn dresses really well for Parliament, and he's really conscious of the needs of our community. He's the one that wears the clothes that Oxfam rejects.
But then you were Beard Man of the Year, weren't you?
Beard of the Year quite a few times. I've won that. Sometimes there have been some close contests, and my friends have got on the, you know,
got close. But you pioneered the great beard.
Absolutely,
So
having a good beard is a good thing. Well, yours is pretty good.
Yeah.
I like the pointer on your beard.
Yeah, no, it's sculpted. Well, I think you've got more hair on your head than me but I think, you know, when you go bald, the only option is Baroque facial hair, really. That's the only... So I have this kind of Van Dyke. You may find that.
Well, the Van Dyke look,
Jalal is also got this.
So I'm kind of lucky, really. I've got a bit of the above, isn't it?
A bit of both, yeah.
Wilf is also here sitting in the doorway. He'd like to know how... he'd like to know how El Gatto is getting on.
Wilf, is it?
Yeah, Wilf Mabanga. You may know.
Hello, how you doing? Well, if I'd known you were here, I'd have brought El Gatto with me. And
we could have had a play date or something, yeah.
Well, they could have had a big scratch together, couldn't they? Because I find that cats are very possessive of their district, you know.
Yeah, well, he's since we've been, you know, locked down, he won't... He's got used to us being here all the time now.
Well, El Gatto got fed up with us being at home. You know, sort of, you know, by about 11 in the morning. Come on, you know.
How did he... So
jog on, you know. You're supposed to be my house during the day, you know. No, he's defending the shed roof from all intruders.
Wow, good for him.
He does that every day. From other cats, you know. It's quite hard work. He has to spend the whole day on the shed roof keeping the other cats off it.
Yeah.
Tom Watson's cat is keeping up. So anyway, we have known each other for many years as political comrades, but we've never really... I remember you showed me that cupboard. You took me into that cupboard in the House of Commons that you and Tony Benn...
Emily Wilde and Davidson hid.
Yeah, and you put up a plaque. You and Tony Benn put up a plaque. Yeah. And then she was ready to later run over by the King's horse.
Yes, she ran out and tried, thought the horse would stop in the Derby. Bloody thing didn't.
She didn't know that horses don't have brakes.
That's right. And sadly, she died. But she was trampled. The part that isn't often recorded is that her funeral in Maupas was massive, and her body was taken from where she was found dead in the hospital by carriage and so on to a train, King's Cross, and the streets were lined with people for her body to get on the train. And then the train went slowly north to Maupas, and the Women's Social and Political Union made a lot of it. So there was purple bunting and a massive funeral there. And so she was like seen as a great martyr. Had we had television then, it would be not quite as big, but the equivalent of Princess Diana and her death.
Well, except they probably would have they probably would have suppressed it, blocked it out. They would have
she was very interesting woman.
But we've never really, I mean, what I'm interested in, and obviously you can talk about whatever you want, but I am interested in, you've been through an experience that nobody else has been through, in a way. I mean, and I know you're not necessarily somebody who talks personally about themselves, but I am curious to know, you know, what was that like, you know, if you want to talk, you know, on whatever level you want to talk about the experience that you've been through the last 5 years, that all our hopes and dreams rested on you, that you came very close to bringing about a kind of democratic socialism, or you're still in the process of bringing it about, and where we go from now. Does that seem...
It seems like a reasonable start of a 10,
So actually, there's a quote from Owen Hatherley. This is what Owen Hatherley said, the architectural critic. "Truly, I curse Jeremy Corbyn and John McDonald for inadvertently dragging me in 2015 into the world of people who have bookshelves lined with political biographies, follow polls, care who Neil Kinnock is, and think Philip Larkin is our greatest poet." I don't know why he's having a go at Philip Larkin, but being simultaneously constantly angry and constantly bored is no way to spend anyone's time. And that's sort of my experience as well, to some extent, that I never thought about the Labour Party or never had any hope, just kind of basked in cynicism. And then when you came to power in 2015, I was suddenly filled with, this kind of extraordinary sense of optimism, of hope, really. And obviously it's been a rocky ride since then, so I don't know where you want to start.
Rocky ride,
well, it is, for me it has been also a remarkable journey to see. I always knew the game was rigged. I never knew to what extent, to how entirely it was rigged. And I don't know, do we start there?
I think that's a fair point. I stood for leader of the party because nobody else would, of the left. There was a big debate on the left about whether we should even contest the election at all. I was of the view we should, just to show that we're still around. Eventually the Socialist Campaign Group, very small meeting, eventually said...
It's like those 12 men in the boat that founded the Chinese Communist Party.
It wasn't as many as... If we had 12, we'd have been far more confident. So it was quite a small meeting.
Yeah.
So John McDonald rules himself out and said, "No, I've done that." Diane said, "I'm not doing it anymore." And I'm there with my little notebook. See, I do everything with little notebooks.
All right.
Nice little notebook. All my notes are in there, everything, casework, the lot. So I'm sort of writing stuff.
But stationery is how people's stationery is fascinating. So it's an orange leather bound.
It's an orange leatherette, I think is the word. So I don't want people to get carried because there might be some vegans listening to this who get upset.
Oh, yeah.
And it's got here, for example, you were there last week, the Stop the War.
Yeah,
it's got my my speech there.
Oh, wow. It's written in pencil and it's...
It's shorthand.
It's like it's not shorthand, shorthand but just notes.
It's illegible, actually.
Illegible hand.
Is that Arabic? Yeah.
Well, it could be a lot. The problem is, when I write these notes, I can't read them.
Yeah.
I can't follow. I can't read it anyway. And so I used to wind up Seamus Milne by saying, I'm on my way to Glasgow. I've got my speech ready, and then photograph the page in my notebook and send it to him. And he would then be sort of tearing his hair out. What are the media going to make of this? How am I going to deal with it? And of course, I can't read it either. But the act of writing it puts the process in my mind.
Right. So
it's like a sort of brain insert through a notebook. You should try it.
The triumph, the speech I gave introducing you at the Palestinian rally where I had no idea. I find speeches very difficult personally, but you know, when I said, you know, I was just busking really until I kind of said, I don't know whether for those who didn't see it, I don't know whether the current leader of the opposition is here. At least I haven't seen the little shitbag. Here's the real leader of the opposition, ladies and gentlemen, Jeremy Corbyn. So anyway,
in 2015, my name was put forward because nobody else would do it. So as I'm making notes in my book, the meeting's gone quiet. There's only about eight of us there anyway. So I looked up and said, what are you looking at me for? And pointed, said, you've got to do it. You're the one who's pushed us into this position, so you've got to do it. I said, oh, all right. At that point, Diane Abbott goes like that. Tweeted out already.
Oh, right.
She drafted the tweet and pressed send at that point.
God.
She's sharp.
Yeah.
Diane is sharp.
So anyway, you were locked into it. But at this point, as you say, it's with open eyes.
It was fascinating and exciting. It unleashed an whole lot of forces against austerity, for peace, for human rights, for environment and so on, who all came together in that summer of 2015.
But how did it feel to you personally? If I know you say because it was a small meeting, you're used to those, being on the left, and then suddenly there is this extraordinary kind of focus on you that suddenly all these people you're suddenly the focus of all these people's hopes and dreams and beliefs. Did that come as a shock? Were you surprised?
Well, I take it as a responsibility that I'd taken on the position. I had to therefore go out and do my best to win it.
Yeah.
It also, of course, provokes a lot of extremely unpleasant media attention from the right, I've had plenty of that in the past, but never to this extent or that this intensity.
And yeah. So
it then became quite apparent that from 2 days after that, my life would never be my own again.
Yeah. I've been in situations which are only a thousandth of as intense as what you've been through. But it's tough, isn't it? Nobody, I think, outside can understand it, you know, just that the poisonous kind of the idea that there's people out there who really hate you. And also, I think one of the reasons that it's sometimes why they put you under pressure, your enemies, is that it makes it hard to think straight sometimes.
Yeah.
Did you find that?
They want you to conform to something which is unspecific what it is, but they want you to conform to something, and you therefore have to be strong and stick to what you believe in. And so it's quite hard to stay focused on what you want to do. And in that summer, it was like a sort of parallel life. We were trying to get nominations from MPs who were extremely reluctant to nominate me. Mm. We had to get 35. And at the same time, build a campaign which simply didn't exist. We had no campaign at all. We had my credit card. It lasted a week. And that was it. But then things happened. People jumped up and did things. people, Ben Sellers and Seb, my son, and others got immediately involved in social media to try and get MPs to nominate me. Unite, Jenny Formby and others got in touch and said they would do what they can to give me help and support very early on. Lots of people from all over the country got in touch and said, what can we do to help? And we just got on the road, and we were already locked into doing all these formal debates that the election campaign requires. And I've never forgotten going to Nuneaton for the first of the television ones. It was a Newsnight hustings in Nuneaton. Nuneaton because it's a place we have had in the past and have got to win in the future. And Andy Burnham and Liz Kendall and so on were there. And Yvette Cooper were all there. And they all had...
They were so shit. I mean,
massive, well-oiled machines. They had this whole group of people also marching around them together, giving them printed speeches, giving them this, giving them that. And Seb, Andrew Fisher, Laura and me turn up. Yeah. And the guy on the door of the BBC said, well, welcome, Mr. Corbyn. Where's your team?
I said, they're here.
Yeah. They're here.
But that's precisely with all this machinery that Liz Kendall, I mean, there was... just unbelievably fucking boring what they said. Oh, we just came out with a clear statement.
Yeah. We have got to end austerity.
Yeah. And jumping, I mean, I don't know whether you want to jump about on this, but I mean...
Always jump about.
Well, we come to the current... we come to, you know, I mean, a man who makes Liz Kendall, the current incumbent, in my opinion, seemed like Iggy Pop. I mean, a man of such dullness that the current leader of the Labour Party, the little shitbag.
But leadership is about listening and about empathising. It's not about dictating. That was probably my big problem. But I'm in favour of democracy and listening. Quite a lot of people would have been preferred me to bit more into the dictating.
Yeah, well, that's, I mean, they're definitely, that the plan is definitely a top-down rather than a bottom-up. So you go to Nuneaton. I mean, you started this just to kind of make a point, you know, this is what I've read from the 57 books I've read about that period. I probably know it better than you, in a way. That you just thought you were making a point, that and they thought, you know, that's why you got nomination from, like, Margaret Beckett and stuff. Because, you know, just to have the sham of having a left voice. So then, and you were making the point and you didn't think that, but then suddenly you started to think, this is, when did
quite,
you think
quite something? Quickly, actually, because I was, first of all, pleased that we got to the position we were contesting, put my name in, and we then started getting some nominations. We were quite a way off, but we did, you know, obviously get there in the end. But it was the numbers of people who were just emailing, phoning and getting in touch saying, what can we do to help, all over the country, and a lot of people in unions. And then perhaps one of the turning points was that there were many, but one was we at this hustings, Labour Party hustings for the Eastern Region. It was in Stevenage, I think it was. And at the end of it, they said, right, final word from each candidate. It was me first and the others to go. And I said, thanks, everyone, for being here. When I leave here, I'm getting the train down to London because I'm joining the anti-austerity march. And since everybody has said here that they're very concerned about austerity, I hope the other candidates will join me.
Snap! they were all presumably going off.
There was plenty of space on the train. And so we went to London for the rally. And then when we were walking to join it, because we got the train into Westminster, then walked across in Parliament Square, it was absolutely huge. And then Mark Sawatka was chairing it. And he then described in words of half a syllable that the process was you could become a registered supporter or join the Labour Party in order to get a vote. And he said, listen, guys, if you really want to have somebody who's opposed to austerity, you've got to do something, join or register.
Yeah, yeah.
And this massive rally then responded very well to that, and then I spoke afterwards. And it was at that point I realised that there was a broad, I hate to use the word coalition, but broad embrace of people of the left, of different causes and groups that were prepared to come together and get involved in this campaign.
And how did that make you feel?
Well, it made me feel then that there was now a sea change in the whole thing. And the sea change was that, A, we were going to be on the ballot, we were going to get there, and we were going to give it a good fist. And then as time went on, I mean, I don't spend a lot of time reading opinion polls, so I don't really believe them, but I'm not a betting man at all, but you follow the bookies.
Right, yeah.
Now, somebody said, follow the bookies. Anyway, they started off giving me 1,000 to 1, and some guy in my road put money down on 1,000 to 1.
Wow. Did he give you a share?
No, he hustled the hell out of me for the whole of the campaign, saying, please make sure you win. Every time I saw him, he said, how's it going? How's it going? I said, what are you actually doing to support it? He said, I'm worrying.
I mean, affairs.
He must, I don't know how much he put down. Yeah. He must have made, whatever he put down, he must have made a lot.
At first, I suppose, the media, because you're a novelty, treated you kindly, didn't they? Did you feel
for
like...
For a few weeks, they were relatively, relatively kind, yeah, for a few weeks.
But then you...
And then they realised that how strong the campaign was and how it was building up. From our point of view, it was very hard to keep pace with it all. And so we had no staff, we had no team, we had nothing.
It's a massive undertaking. I mean, again, running an imaginary sandwich bar, as I do, is difficult enough. Yeah. Running a campaign to take over the opposition in a Western democracy must be
so we just
very
brought
difficult.
People in, volunteers and so on, all came in, and there was a great buzz and a great atmosphere surrounding it. And
at that time, you felt very optimistic and on a high.
And we did this phone banking. To Labour Party supporters registered and so on. That came later on. But that was an incredible operation. And one night we had like several hundred people in the Unite offices in Holborn phone bank, and it was the biggest phone bank ever.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just chaotic. There was hundreds of people on these cheap as chips mobile phones phoning up people recording JC1, JC2, whatever the choice of voting was. And then we were tabulating all that. And it was all looking very, very interesting and very promising. And so by somewhere into July, late July, August, it became a possibility, no more, not a possibility that we would win it. And the crowds got bigger and bigger.
I remember the meeting around here that was where
it just got bigger. And then we had I don't know if you were there, that one at Camden.
You were there. Were you there, Lynn?
I went to loads and I went to the Troxy.
Every time we go past the Troxy, she's...
And the state in Kilburn.
Yeah.
Well, so, yes.
Yeah.
And when we walked round the corner to go to the one at the Camden Centre, I was with Simon Fletcher, who was the manager of the office and campaign. And we were in the TSSA and we said, oh, we'll go around and get ready for the rally, the one at the Camden Centre. So we walked round there and you see this big crowd of people. I said, well, is there a concert on or something? And he said, no, it's for you. I said, you're joking, you know. So we then had all these overflow meetings. And there was that great picture of these kids climbing in a window to get in.
Oh, such happy days. We'll never... So you got the job.
I got the job.
Moving forward, what was that? I mean, well, let me ask you this question, which is, obviously this was all about you getting the job. The Labour Party. The Labour Party. What's that all about? I mean, what's that all about, Labour Party?
Long podcasts?
I grew up in politics, which is further than to the left of the Labour Party, so I never was showed much interest. It's only the last few years that I have. It seemed to me that the Labour Party and the history of the Labour Party might indicate that, in a sense, its purpose is to siphon off the socialistic instincts of the British working class and to bog them down in proceduralism, in kind of, you know, to enthuse them and then induce despair in them. On the other hand, I can see that the left has always had, you know, all these tiny, you know, the left has tried to...
It is the place.
It is the place, yeah. But how do you, I mean, how do you get beyond, you know, this process that you went through has happened several times before, and you must have known that, like George Lansbury in 1985, Nye Bevin was expelled from the Labour Party for supporting, because the Labour Party had a policy of non-intervention in the Spanish Civil War, a war against fascism. The Labour Party took a neutral fucking position, you know. Michael Fort, obviously, Tony, you know. I mean, so how do you... And I can understand why... Well, I know...
Well, the Labour Party is full of contradictions, and its foundation was an interesting process of an amalgamation of a number of socialist societies, and eventually with trade union support, and then setting up what was a federal structure in 1918, which followed by constituency parties. And originally, they were trades and labour councils. So it was a trade union basis on which the campaigns were organised locally. But the parliamentary party asserted itself, and the parliamentary party became the vehicle for electing the leader. And there was forever after that a tension between party members, unions, and the parliamentary party. And that tension is there today.
Yeah.
It remains so. And so the process of democracy in the Labour Party is a long-running sore. Indeed, I was a founder member of the Campaign for Labour Party Democracy in 1970 because we wanted to change that. The Labour Party at its best has got to be a vehicle for social change. And I stood for leadership of it, fully aware of the power of the Labour Party bureaucracy, fully aware of the triumphs and the tragedies of the past. I mean, I was in Parliament when we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan and so on, and voted against it, obviously. My point was that we could now recruit a large number of people into the party. We could use these registered supporters as a way of hopefully converting them into members, but above all, turn the party into a community-based, community organising operation, which our later head of chief of staff in my office, Carrie Murphy, put a huge amount of energy into trying to develop community organising. That met with huge opposition amongst the bureaucracy. So go back a bit. From the point when I was elected leader, there was a feeling of enormous elation, obviously. And I wanted to start as I meant to go on. And I announced to the consternation of all my team from the platform when I was declared the leader of the party that my first act as leader of the party would be go to a demonstration saying refugees are welcome. And it's not that they didn't think refugees should be welcome. They just thought...
To state that.
This is... a logistical, et cetera, nightmare. What on earth are you going to do that for?
Yeah.
And so I looked at them all from the platform and said, and now my first act is going to be that.
Anyway, you've never had media training, I take it.
No. Never had any training in anything. So we went and did the rally because I wanted to make the point that I was not going to go down the road of appeasing the...
Yeah.
Right in politics, who build up this hatred of refugees.
And I suppose the
refugees are human beings like you and me.
Yeah.
In a different world, you and I could be refugees.
I think I would.
I would be and very bad one. Your family. Yeah. Your family. Well, I was.
My family were. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And
my family are.
Your family are.
My Syrian cousins. So, you know.
Yeah.
And hats off to you. Like, I'm very grateful for your stand on that.
Absolutely. I mean, that's surely how we have to be. So I wanted to make that statement. Anyway, so I made that statement, spoke at that rally, and then started meeting the Labour Party senior staff, many of whom I'd never heard of before. And then the next thing was the construction of a shadow cabinet.
Right.
I then realised, well, I knew all along the problems we had.
But it's like the fucking, you know.
I had dinner with John McDonald that night with a lot of other people in Troyer Restaurant, you know, the one by the South Bank. And but then it kind of hit home big time. How do we construct a team that will support what we've fought in this campaign? Answer, you can't, because look at the size of the Parliamentary Labour Party and attitudes in it. So that was a big problem. But as time went on during my leadership, it got a lot better. It got a lot better after the 2017 election. And so we got some good people in. Now, I know 2019 was a disastrous result. Tell me about it. I know that. But had we won that election, look at the people who had become MPs in 2017, who would have been elected in 2019, you'd have a very, very different...
But the problem is they're never going to let... I mean, you had, you know, people in the headquarters conspiring against you, siphoning off money, you know, conspiring in many ways. You had the entire Conservative press against you, and you had a lot of the people in the PLP conspiring against you. And the problem was that they were never going to let it happen.
We had a huge range of opposition. That I know, of course, I do. From the media, 91% of the media was opposed, or maybe I'm exaggerating, perhaps it was only 88.
I think you probably understate, yeah. Well, I understand. 173%.
Well, I think so, 5% were neutral, you see. Yeah. But the level of attacks and misinformation in the media was...
Unbelievable.
Was phenomenal.
The lies, the
there was, and it was sort of like, some of it was kind of laughable, like the Daily Express said, he rides a Maoist bicycle. I mean, I ride a bicycle.
And it's bicycles a trek. Don't have.
I've got two bikes actually. Yeah. And I didn't tell them I got two bikes. That would have been
capitalist.
That would have been a whole new set of stories. Two bikes, Corbyn. I've got a trek, which is made in Taiwan, and a rally that's made in China.
Right.
So this became a Maoist bike. So it's the first Maoist bike made in Taiwan.
Yeah, it was like the case of Angela Eagle's brick. That was an early one. Do you remember that? Angela's brick, where a left-wing militants threw a brick through Angela Eagle's constituency
alleged.
Office. It's alleged. It turned out there was no brick and no window. The Merseyside police diverted resources, presumably from, investigating robberies and assaults, and put the finest members of their team to investigate this fucking non-existent brick in a non-existent fucking window.
The media harassment was unbelievable. I installed some new windows in the front of my house, which people are perfectly entitled to do. I applied for and received the appropriate consents from the local authority to do it. Okay?
Yeah.
All fine. I had wanted to put a bay window in. The council refused permission. I didn't put it in. The Daily Mail then ran a story saying Corbyn tries to despoil street. And then sent a journalist knocking every single door in the street, asking people to say how offended they were by the new windows being put in my house.
Yeah.
And so this,
with the non-existent windows in your house, that you the non-existent windows that you weren't putting into your house.
Exactly. Yeah, and anyway,
I mean, what's the difference? My
street's very loyal. Yeah. They told him to buzz off.
Yeah.
So you could hear the sound of slamming doors all down the street as he went down.
I mean, where's the difference between that and, I sometimes watch Russia Today, which has some interest, you see a panel of experts, they're all obviously on the government payroll or, spouting the Moscow, the Putin line. But you think, really, where's the difference between that and Good Morning Britain, Sky News? Where's the fucking difference? It's exactly the fucking same.
Well, what I'd hoped was, and to some extent it worked, was that the whole development of social media could begin to change the face of politics. Because you and I have grown up in a non-social media age. I mean, when I was a young political activist, to me, the height of political activity achievement would be to write a leaflet on my hand typewriter at home, which my mum gave me as a 16th birthday present, put that on a skin, on a Gestetner. Yeah. Gestetner, not Ronio. I always use Gestetner myself.
The Gestetner was the duplicator of the revolutionary movement.
It was the go-to duplicator. And then I had a Gestetner at home, a hand Gestetner, which had seen service with the Eighth Army.
I don't know where to go with that, really.
It was a very old one, is the point I'm making.
Yeah.
And I would then... rind the handle for several hours whilst putting the ink on by hand. This was
silkscreen. That was the other thing. Did you?
And then we do silkscreen print. And then we produce anyway. And then cut them with a hand guillotine, which had no guard on it. So we're lucky our fingers remained. And then we would then go out and distribute these leaflets and think we'd done a great job, that we'd produced a leaflet, printed 1,000 of them, and give them out. A huge amount of effort for 4 people. You can press a button now and reach 1 million people immediately. Yeah. And so I believed, and I think there's a lot in it, that social media can begin to change things.
It did for a while, yeah.
It did, but all of us have got to think about this. When it matters, social media isn't there. Indian farmers on the cusp of winning.
Yeah.
Mysteriously.
Sounds, yeah.
Twitter, Facebook, YouTube, nothing works on those particular streets of New Delhi at that time.
Yeah.
And the power to shut people down is through that as well. And so that's why, maybe we'll come on to this, the Project for Peace and Justice, which I founded, is concentrating very heavily on the question of media access and media ownership and media activity and news values. Your point about news values, the experts sitting there all agreeing austerity is a good thing.
Yeah.
Saw a film the other night on Channel 5, I think it was, on life on a nuclear submarine. You've got to be an hour and a half into the film before anybody says, oh, by the way, the nuclear warheads on this are equivalent to half the bombs that were dropped in World War II.
Yeah.
And that's what we're not mentioning.
Yeah, it's just the jolly banter between
the
crew members.
It's all
members.
About
the
quality of the food in the galley.
Yeah, yeah. Because obviously you're deeply moral, very funny, very personable person.
Oh, come on, I'm not funny. Listen, I'm a bitter tongued old misery. It says so in the Daily Mail.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well,
whereas
somebody like Tony Blair, fucking skull on a stick, somebody who has spent the last few years pimping himself out to real murderers, is allowed to be some kind of moral arbiter, is vaunted as somebody who presents a moral position, whereas you are excoriated as, because you want, you once bought somebody in Hezbollah a sandwich. I mean, did you try and get that view of yourself out? Was it blocked, or do you feel now that you could have done a better job with that?
Well,
I mean, I sometimes think that Seamus Milne is to be mildly critical, it was, I don't know, it's an odd choice of, comms chief in a way.
Well, Seamus is a great comrade and great friend and is very good at analysing what goes on politically. To be fair to him and others, they probably would have wanted me to do more sort of personal stuff than we did, because I don't like doing personal. I didn't want me to be made into, it's all about me. It's about a movement.
I'll tell you what, when I've had legal troubles, when I was sued for libel, for instance, or I had accountancy troubles, I quickly learned to hire the biggest bastard you can find, the most aggressive, nastiest Rottweiler. Yeah. And I think that what you could have done with one of them, and you didn't have one. I mean, because do you think, I don't know, is that unfair?
There is a point there. But you see, my instincts are that I want the next generation to be more empowered than this one. I want them to be more hopeful than this one. I want them to be more able to achieve huge change. If you set everything up around one person, dictate what happens, and you might stay in office, you might stay in power, you might achieve some changes, but have you achieved a long-term change? Now, my whole project was about empowering and democratizing, and hence I spent an awful lot of time traveling around the country, addressing groups of people, round tables and all the rest of it, with the idea to enthuse them into being activists. Now, that is, I think, very important. Should we have done more and being more aggressive with the media? Listen, we were faced with an avalanche, an absolute avalanche of abuse. And I just felt sorry often for James Schneider and others who worked in our office. They would be batting off one abusive, nasty, dishonest, horrible story about me or about Laura or about my boys, Ben, Seb and Tommy or somebody, and they'd be the whole day dealing with this kind of nonsense. Mm-hmm. And so after a while, you end up under siege. Mm-hmm. When you're under siege, you don't have an awful lot of time or opportunity to go out and sow the fields for next year.
Yeah, and that's part of the part.
Which, of course, is part of what it's about.
Yeah,
And they do it legally. They do it by media abuse and tie you all in knots all the while. And so it is, you have to make a lot of effort to consciously try and develop new policies, develop activity. But I think, in fairness, we did a lot of that.
Yeah.
Despite all that was thrown at us from 2015 onwards and the coup in 2016 and all the hostility of the Parliamentary Labour Party, we set out a different strategy. I made the apology on Iraq, which I'd promised I would do and did, on the day of the Chilcot report. And I promised I'd do it, and I did it to an audience of the families of soldiers who had lost their lives there. And in 2017, we produced an amazing manifesto for the many, not the few.
Yeah.
And that was all done under siege.
I mean,
so don't underestimate the amazing loyalty and work by people in my office and in my team, and also the negativity and backstabbing that went on as well.
Yeah. And, you know, yeah, that is a remark. I mean, when you put it like that, and I do, I think it's an extraordinary achievement with under that level of attack to have got as far as you did. And I suppose it's a testament to you, the power of what you do, that the sole purpose of Starmer's Labour Party, really, is not winning votes, is not fairness, is not challenging austerity, is not speaking for the oppressed.
And nobody believed us in 2017 at the start of the campaign that we could win it.
Yeah.
The day it was announced, I had various people coming up to me saying, why don't you just resign now? I said, well, thanks for your support. I'll see you on the campaign trail.
I remember listening.
By the way, which constituency do you represent? You know?
On election day, I remember a BBC correspondent going around Croydon, and he couldn't find a single person to say anything bad about you. And it was, yeah, it was so exciting. But what I was going to say was the entire purpose of the Labour Party at the moment, as we speak, is unravelling your legacy, isn't it? That's all they care about. That is the only fucking thing that they
are. Well, I'm looking forward to being in Brighton because I've got a few meetings and rallies coming up in which I want to take it further forward. Listen, austerity has meant food banks and food co-ops. Austerity has meant shorter lives. Austerity has meant unbelievable levels of poverty in Britain. And underfunding of local government means councils simply cannot keep going.
I mean, and that was the,
and I'm going to say all that.
Yeah.
And we don't defeat that by pleasing the Daily Mail and the Daily Express.
Yeah, which like fucking Ed Balls and Ed Miliband in 2015, wouldn't he, because some fucking focus group or something had told them that, you know, they allowed the Tories to say that Labour had caused, you know, I mean, it's that my line that James O'Brien always quotes about, the worldwide financial crash of 2008 was caused by Wolverhampton having too many libraries.
Yeah.
I mean, it's, those two cretins.
I'm glad you revealed the truth about that. Because I've always thought that library in Technol is a bit excessive.
It's strictly not
necessary. It's not in the centre of Wolverhampton. It should be moved.
That's what tipped the world.
Will you come there and help me move it?
Yeah.
But those two idiots fucking allowed the wouldn't contest for some weaselly. That's one of the other thing I want to say about Blair Hoffman.
Well, also, we went into that election promising to continue the wage freeze.
Yeah. I mean, the cowardice of that.
So we go into an election, and I remember a 2015 general election. There was some good stuff in the manifesto, no question about that. There was, but somebody, I remember knocking on a door on one of the estates in my constituency, and the person comes to the door and says, yeah. I said, okay. He said, yeah, I'll vote for you, Jeremy. Yeah, yeah. I said, where do you work? He said, oh, DWP. Said, okay. He said, I'm just a bit unhappy about the wage freeze. So I said, why? He said, I haven't got any money. and I see my income diminishing before my eyes. And he was right. Of course he was right.
Yeah.
And
but so, with this new...
So you think, hang on, what are we offering? yes, we were some good housing policies, but unless you actually put money in people's pockets, then you have a double whammy. One is they're poor. The second is the local spending power is reduced and local shops close and all the rest of it.
Yeah, and Starmer's not even offering that. I think he's not even offering the bollocks of the two heads, really. What should I ask now? Go on.
Like a lot of people on the left at the moment, you know, the purges and so on. I'd like to know what you think we can have as hope. I want some more hope, please.
And Carrie?
What's good at the moment?
So, obviously there are 7 unions on the left. We've held back the creation of a, because there is a void in us, right? We've held back the creation of the organisation because we need Jeremy and his partner leadership.
Would you mind answering that over here?
Carrie, come and sit here. You see, this is she's wonderful, but she can be a Rottweiler.
This is your Alistair Campbell. Can you play
the call
bad
sweet Carrie Murphy?
I call her sweet Carrie Murphy, but...
You're his bastard. You're his enforcer.
I'm a very kind person, but I get this terrible reputation.
Carrie is an unbelievably kind person and does kindnesses all the time, which she doesn't even tell people about.
Yeah.
I hear about them from others.
Yeah, and again, that's not, you know, that's never... You wouldn't know about that in the media, would you? You never hear that.
She's got family in my area as well, so I hear about her kindnesses.
No. I mean, that's one of... I mean, that is one of your problems, I think, is that you're all too nice. But Linda joined the Labour Party. It was a roller coaster ride of emotions for her, particularly meeting the right wing of the Labour Party, who she said are some of the most horrible people she's ever met. Or the most horrible people to remember. But she was, you know, with the defeat in 2019, she feels depressed and demotivated. What can you offer in terms of hope?
It was devastating, of course, 2019 election result. We got 32.5% of the vote. We got 10 million plus votes. And obviously we lost seats. With that vote... We would have won every election since 2001, but it's the seat arrangement.
Of course, the MSM doesn't mention that, you know.
Of course not.
Greatest catastrophe.
So it was more votes than achieved by Blair or Brown or Miliband.
Mm.
Okay, even then. Okay. So obviously, I take responsibility for losing the election. I was the leader of the party. I led the party into the election. And I just knew that as soon as that result had come round, there was going to be a whole feeling of devastation and depression amongst activists. And so I set myself up immediately on a course, which Carrie will attest to, of going around the country supporting people and doing rallies and things to try and boost people up, which is what I do all the time. COVID came along, which obviously has changed an awful lot of that. Winning an election would have meant we'd gone into government. Gone into government probably as the largest party, probably not with an overall majority. So we would have had to live or die by being a minority government. We'd have set ourselves a budget that would have been redistributive and all the other things in our policy. We would have had the most unbelievable attacks from the media and many other very, very powerful forces in our society.
Yeah.
And so we would have needed the active support of communities and people all over the country to win. So what the point I'm making is that being in office doesn't automatically bring you the power to make the change. The power to make the change comes from the popular will that goes with it.
Yeah.
The two things go together. We would have had a lot of problems. And so I simply say to people, I want to defeat injustice and inequality. I want to see something real coming out of COP26 and something real about environmental protection. And I want to see us moving to a peaceful world, not a new nuclear pact with goodness knows who to do God knows what. We only achieve all that by mobilisation of people. And so I recognise the devastation. We set up the Project for Justice and Peace as a home for people.
Mm.
I don't know how many of them are in the Labour Party or not. I'm guessing it's probably 50-50, but I don't know. But there are people all over the country who are involved in real political activity, organising delivery workers into a union, fighting for union recognition, setting up food co-ops, setting up clothing co-ops, demanding stuff for COP26, international justice. We did a refugee call. We had 10,000 people on it. I did a speech with Lula and Dilma in Brazil. We had 500,000 people on one meeting we did. So we're building up this sense of alliances. And when you build an alliance up, you empower each other.
Right.
You empower each other. I did one Saturday night from people in Manitoba in Canada. I've never been to Manitoba, but I looked it up on the map. It's big. It's huge. Yeah. It's massive.
Yeah.
Look at it on the map. And I was speaking to Nikki Ashton, who's the MP for there, who has been re-elected, I'm glad to say. And so I kept wanting to ask questions about Manitoba. And she said, Jeremy, can you get on with the politics of it and stop asking questions about Manitoba? And she said, you don't realise how important it is for our scattered people all over Manitoba to hear that their views of a sustainable world, their views of justice, are actually shared by people elsewhere. And so we do that.
Yeah, well, I was at a Palestinian, Palestine last night, and they said you can't overstate if somebody speaks up for Palestine, that you can't overstate how much that means to them.
Exactly.
Really. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, first time I went to Jerusalem, I wasn't leader of the party or anything. I used to have a beautiful green jacket. It was lovely. I love my green jacket. The trouble is, my wife hated it.
It was horrendous, to be honest.
Wait.
Well, it's now at that. It's now in the green jacket. Green jacket purgatory somewhere. So, anyway, I'm so proud of this green jacket.
You bought it from GUM in Moscow or
Fontal Road, actually. I'm walking through the old town in Jerusalem, and this guy shouts, Mr. Jeremy! Because he spotted the green jacket.
All right.
So he came out and literally dragged me into his cafe, sat me down, brought out the coffee, brought out the cakes, and just said, thank you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Because you're one who recognises what the occupation is like.
Yeah.
The only argument we got into was he wouldn't let me pay.
You're a generous people, aren't you?
Yeah,
he just would not allow me to pay. And I said, you've got to expect. I said, you're not making any money. There's no tourists. The whole place, the economy's collapsing. He said, I cannot take money from you.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, yeah. Carrie, because your background is in the trade unions, I mean, do you see some hope there?
Yeah, I think you. I don't think you can adopt a negative view on membership engagement within the Labour Party at the moment. Although people are very demoralised, and trade unionists are clearly with COVID, you know, have massive challenges. But I think there's scope for optimism because Keir Starmer has duped an awful lot of people, but not all of them. I don't think you can erase the content of Jeremy's manifesto in 17 and in 19. Both documents being very, very popular with the vast majority of people. And of course, the British media's propaganda telling the ordinary working classes that these documents are not relevant to their lives. Of course they are. Mm. People have an intellectual insight into what is best for them. And I think personally that having peace and justice is really important, but so is having the British trade union movement. And seven of the big unions are very, very much on the left. And if I say this on behalf of Unite in particular, Sharon Graham's election into the general secretaryship of Unite is very exciting for me. Mm. People want to believe that Sharon is not political. It's not true. She will just do things in her own way. But what we have done in relation to Sharon is the model that we use for community organising in the Labour Party was Sharon's model. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking forward to how, peace and justice can work with Sharon going forward. But there is a void at the moment. And clearly the left are feeling bereft, of activism because there is that void of leadership. That will find its level very soon. That will find its level because Keir Starmer has betrayed the left and people are bright enough to recognise him.
I think one of the things you can feel hopeful about is that they're doing such a shit job. Yeah. I mean, they are so fucking useless at even being bastards.
Yeah, there are peaks and troughs in the Labour Party. Yeah. And, you know, I'm keen for Jeremy to be back in his rightful place within the Labour Party. There is a left block of MPs. There are some fantastic, you know, young MPs like Zara and Richard and Dan Carden and others. And many others, absolutely. Probably at this stage too many to mention, which is great. We worked hard to make sure those voices were in Parliament. But the seven left trade unions will come together with Jeremy and John and others. We'll have the manifestos that, you know, we worked very hard on in 17. People cannot dismiss. The minute the Daily Mail says it's one lot of shit, people out there know it's not true. So I remain optimistic for the future. Am I shocked and horrified about, you know, Keir's betrayal? Actually, I'm not. You know, that was masquerading. There is no doubt there is a purge against the left just now.
Isn't it? That JVL said, if you're a Jewish socialist, you are 200 times more likely than anybody else to be expelled from the Labour Party for hatred of Jews. I mean, what kind of Kafkaesque bollocks is that?
Utterly preposterous. But you know what? I'm out and about as Jeremy is. I live in the Gordbos and I'm out and about. People can see right through this. Gone are the days when they're going to kid these people on. You know, my biggest fear for the Labour Party is the absolute drubbing it's going to get come the next general election. You know, I don't fear as a left-winger my future. I fear for the future of the Labour Party.
I don't feel defeated.
If the Labour Party do not represent working-class people, they are nothing. They are without purpose.
I don't feel defeated any more than Carrie does. I travel a lot. I mean, I'm all over the place all the time travelling. And a number of people that come up to me and just say, you know, really sorry about what happened, what you said was right. More interestingly, people come along and say, I thought you were wrong at the time. I now realise the sense of what you were saying in the 2019 election. Yeah. They see the NHS being sold off to Serco and everybody else. And they say, well, actually, you're the one that predicted all of this.
Yeah.
You remember that document I brought out against Johnson? Showing the secret negotiation happened with the USA to sell off the NHS.
Yeah.
Where were our media picking that up?
They ridiculed it
and said, it's come from Russia.
I
really struggled with that one.
Yeah.
How did Russia get involved in producing a document about secret talks that Johnson was having in the USA about our NHS to give to me to use at a television debate in Sheffield?
Yeah.
And you know what? I never met one Russian all day.
Well,
I think peace and justice is a holding place for people who have got the same values and principles as we have. But the British trade union movement, organised labour, is key to this. And we will work in partnership with organised labour and we will community organise because the link between us and the working classes is imperative. And if Keir Starmer doesn't recognise that that's how you win a general election, he will never win a general election.
Well, I think that's
there will
true.
Be an opportunity for the left again. So our ask to people is, if you're not in the Labour Party, be in peace and justice. Be in both if you want. But if you're not in the Labour Party, join peace and justice.
And there's no secret plan for peace and justice to spin off into a new party.
There's no secret plans of any sort. My desk is small and very open and they look at it every day.
The secret plan is for Jeremy Corbyn to be back in the Labour Party and we will work with the British trade unions on the left going forward.
The secret plan is to mobilise people as a mass movement. Whatever happens after that happens. Tomorrow, young people are going to be in central London. Climate change. Scarlett Westbrook has organised it. Wonderful young woman. She invited me to go there. I'll be there tomorrow. We've got all these events in Brighton next week, which are going to be outdoors, doing a big rally on Sunday afternoon. And then we're going to be doing rallies and stuff in Glasgow around COP26. And we do a lot of international stuff. I was on an earlier call about the occupied territories and I'm doing a meeting this evening about the new nuclear deal. So we're very, very active on all these things, on social justice, on housing, supporting ACORN for tenants and so on. And our project is inundated with requests for help and support. I'm very comfortable with that. Being inundated with help, with people who want help and support, fine. That's what we're there for. It's not a problem for us. It's a pleasure. I mean, it's obviously logistically all very difficult all the time, but that's life. Mm.
Yeah,
but I think I remember being asked a question once, or somebody said, you know, you're under enormous stress. This was during the coup in 2016. I said, no, I'm not under stress. I've got food in the fridge at home. I'm not going to starve tonight. And if everything goes totally pear-shaped, I've got a house to live in. When you're under stress is when you're a triage nurse in a hospital and you haven't got enough beds. When you're under stress is when you've got mental health problems and your kids are acting up and you've got nowhere to live, you're homeless, and your kids are going to be taken into care. That's stress. That's the kind of stress that the newspapers never, ever report. They always put stress down as something that sports people or celebrities are going through. The mental health crisis in this country is as much brought about by poverty and inequality as it is from any sort of medical condition.
Yes, I agree.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that's never said about the project, early, you know, our administration had, you know, there was a lot of crisis, and you're right, but we were besieged a lot of the time.
It was a crisis every
but
day.
But by God, did we get some fantastic moral support from ordinary people who made us smile every single day. You know, it wasn't a drudgery, was it, Jeremy? You know, we went in there and we had...
After the election in 2019...
We believed in it
so much. We had...
we had some fun.
Boxes and boxes of Christmas cards. We opened 10,000. Mm. Just tons of cards. Most of them with no address on, just a message. Mm. And 99% of them, the mirror image of the British media, were supportive.
Yeah.
And it was extraordinary, wasn't it? You remember that? And we emails coming out your ears.
You could feel the love in the streets. Yeah, you could feel that. It's tangible.
Hello, listeners. It's me, Talal, from the Alexis L podcast, and I'm sorry to interrupt this chat with, who was it again? Oh yeah, Jeremy Corbyn. And I promise I won't be long, but I just wanted to pop in here and remind you the best way in which you can support this show, and that's by visiting our Patreon, of course. Look, we really don't want to have any adverts on this show ever. And really the best way we can do that is to turn to you for support, because, you know, everyone who helps makes the show needs to make a living, and we buy certain equipment, especially for the bike rides as well. And of course, Audio Boom takes a fee because we're not getting any adverts, and etc., etc. Podcasting ain't cheap, yo! And so, look, we really, really, really appreciate everyone who's already subscribed to the Patreon. We love every single one of you. You guys are awesome. And if you want to join the party, get on board, head over to patreon.com/AlexisSaleHPodcast. That's patreon.com/AlexisSaleHPodcast. You guys are amazing. Thank you so much. I think that's it. Follow us on Instagram, AlexisSalePod, at AlexisSalePod on Instagram. I like to post little things there, keep you guys posted, little clips from the show, maybe behind the scenes photographs, fan art, stuff like that. Okay, I'm done. Let's get back to our chat with Mr. Jeremy Corbyn.
The president of Mexico is a mate of yours, isn't he?
AMLO, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that was sort of another... I watched Sicario last night. I've seen it before. Yeah. How does he manage to govern Mexico?
With some difficulty.
At least you haven't got the cartel. Well, you have got different kinds of cartels who are even more...
Well, Lara, my wife, says that the political pressures and abuse in Britain and the West... are probably worse than Mexico. Because
really?
In Mexico, it's very obvious.
Yeah.
It's very obvious who your enemies are. It's very obvious who your friends are.
Yeah.
Here.
Yeah, yeah. So they,
you know, they all say, never smile at a crocodile.
Yeah.
Don't be taken in by his friendly grin. The day before...
So the Matamoros cartel are not as bad as Labour First. That's what you're saying.
With AMLO, the day before he became president, and we went to his house in Palenque, and then we travelled together to Mexico City. And I've known him for a long time. We got on very well. And so we're travelling and talking about his hopes and so on. And I said, well, God, you've got a lot coming up. How do you feel about it? He said, nervous and excited, as you were. And he said, I said, is there anything you want that we can help support with and so on. This was the year some
shut up,
ago,
Wilf.
Some while ago. And he said, can we have your NHS? Can we have your NHS? It's because Mexico has no comprehensive health system.
Yeah, and yet, hasn't it got the richest man in the world in Carlos Slim?
Yes, I think there's a connection here.
Yeah, between them. He's, all the money that would have gone to the health service in Mexico has gone
to Carlos. Three medical appointments, half an hour a week on Thursdays.
Mind you, I probably, having slagged off Carlos Slim, am I going to get hit by the Zetas cartel now?
I won't give him your address. It's all right. I'll keep your address is secret.
Muchas gracias. Lynn, is there anything else? I mean,
I'm agreeing with all you're saying about the fire that's been lit around the country, but what I cannot see is any place for the left in the Labour Party. I mean, that seems to be the sole aim of the current regime, is to make sure the left has no place in the Labour Party and will not.
This has been tried before. Yeah. Gaitskell tried it. They tried it after Lansbury.
Yeah. I'll just paraphrase. Linda's just talking about how this concerted effort to remove the left from the Labour Party, and you're saying it's
forever.
This time they think it's, why won't it work this time?
Sorry, Jeremy, I shouldn't respond, but I will respond.
Do.
In the absence of an alternative, the left should remain within the Labour Party, and the only alternative will not be a peace and justice project, but organised labour. And if they provide us with an alternative, of course, the Labour Party has no God-given right to exist, but the vast majority of people that I feel who are experienced and having been done over year in, year out, feel that until there is that alternative there, the home is in, the natural home is within the Labour Party. And what I've said before again is the advantage that we've got is we know it can work. Sure, we made mistakes. We will be wiser the next time. Is there another opportunity? I believe there will be. If there is an alternative out there from organised labour, then people can move like that.
Right, but is the Labour Party this alternative? Because at the moment, all my comrades have been expelled. You know?
Yeah, there is absolutely
the finest and the best as well. I'm very upset about a particular comrade who died yesterday. Who was it? Reaver, you know, you probably come across.
Yeah, I was
Reaver.
With a comrade in Hastings on Sunday night. We were talking about that.
Shame on terrible. Keir Starmer for the purge on the left. Shame on Keir Starmer. Shame on David Evans. Yes. There is no doubt I am not here to defend the structures in the Labour Party.
So if you stay, you're not only giving some kind of money and tacit support, you're also in danger of being labelled like a racist, like an anti-Semite. I mean, it's so upsetting that, you know, these decent, wonderful people who anybody would be proud to stand alongside are being treated like that. You know, so it's a big ask saying stay until you're thrown out.
It is a big ask. And Jeremy and I have both been there, and Jeremy at this moment in time, you know, perversely remains without the whip. I do not defend the Labour Party, and I absolutely do not defend the actions of David Evans or indeed Keir Starmer. What I say is, as a personal view, unless organised labour offers an alternative, watch this space in relation to Sharon Graham. The Bakers, the Fire Brigades Union, Change in Unison. These are all, I think, very interesting moves. Watch this space.
Yeah.
But there is nobody going to push me out of the Labour Party right now, no matter what they throw at me, until there is an alternative. That's my view.
I was in Liverpool for the March Against the Arms Fair, and there were a lot of people there, huge, huge demonstration. And it's a great city. What was interesting was that we marched into the centre of Liverpool. Now, Alexa, you've been on lots of marches in London. You know what it's like. You go down Oxford Street. And you've got this great sense of camaraderie when you're assembling in Hyde Park, and then you set off down Oxford Street, and you get all the crap and abuse and everything else from people shopping. You know, you know how it goes. And then
shopping.
We're walking through the middle of Liverpool. And I'm sort of expecting, why don't you lot get lost, go away, get bigger bombs or whatever. People coming out of the pub, applauding.
Yeah.
And joining in. Now, that's different. Then I went to Wigan for the Diggers Festival. Okay, it's a left-wing festival. Okay, it's a community event. Okay, it is self-selecting. There were thousands of people there from all kinds of groups, some in the Labour Party, some not in the Labour Party, all kinds. They came together. Why? Because they were interested in a festival, having a good time, interested in the history of the Diggers versus the Levellers versus Cromwell, etc. But also, they were mainly campaigning on stopping the cut in universal credit, saving the local hospital, demanding a national care service. And the biggest cheer I got was when he said, I'm fed up with going around the country defending the NHS. I don't want to defend the NHS. I want to extend the NHS and take over private medicine. I want to extend the NHS and have a real national care service. I said, let's campaign for things, not just against something.
Yeah.
Give people something positive to do.
Yeah, we all agree with that. It's making it happen, isn't it?
I relate to that because I'm always, whenever I have a friend, I don't know, this we might cut this up. Whenever I have a, whenever I say friend, whenever I'm in the pub and some dickhead makes a racist joke or like an anti-Semitic joke or something fucking awful, and then because I'm the Arab, they'll look at me and they go, right, and I go, no, fuck you. Like, no.
You need to change your pub.
But it's like, it doesn't happen often, but I guess it used to happen more than it does now. But like, that kind of vibe where people expect me as the Arab to be anti-Jewish or vehemently anti-Israeli even. Yeah. And I'm like, actually, I don't want to allow them or anyone to put that hate in my heart. I'm not anti-Israeli. I'm not anti-Jewish. I'm pro-Palestinian, and those are very different things.
They're totally different, absolutely.
And you don't put that hate in my mouth or in my heart. You know, like, please piss off with that. Don't look at me for approval with that bullshit. And so I really relate to that. Let's campaign for things. Let's support people rather than try and destroy and tear things down.
Now look at the history of people who were fighting racism in this country.
Yeah,
I'm going to be in the East End for the commemoration of the Battle of Cable Street. What was that about? That was an Irish community and Jewish community coming together to defeat Mosley and the fascists. They're trying to march through the East End. Yeah. And who's going to be there? Lots and lots of people, including a very large number of people, no doubt, from the mosque, East London Mosque, and from the whole area. That's what it's about. Unity of communities.
I would talk to Josie Long about this, who's, you know, as a supporter as well, that the vehemence of the hatred towards you, and I tried to kind of find a reason, you know, a psychological reason, which, and I think it's because you showed up, you and obviously the people, you know, you showed up, people thought they were left-wing, and you showed them that they weren't really. Journalists thought that they were independent, and you showed them that they were just glove puppets. And that's one of the reasons, deep down, the contempt that people showed for you. You know, like, particularly like bastards like Peston or...
But, Alexei, you know, this is why we've got to do so much more on the media and why we're having this event in Manchester on October the... 4th of October, yeah, at the People's History Museum.
Alexia is right, though. It is a mixture of terror that you might actually succeed and shame, that people who were masquerading as some sort of kind of liberal, lefty, you know, North London socialist actually are as much part of the establishment as the right wing were.
Yeah.
So I subscribe to that. I agree with that. And Jeremy is genuinely probably too, you know, he's too humble to admit this, but history will judge Jeremy Corbyn very fairly and very warmly. You know, the scales will fall from people's
eyes.
Will
I be around for that judgment?
I sincerely hope so, but one thing I do know, Jeremy has your three boys well, and that's significant to the young people who have supported him.
That vehemence, it's like nobody says, I fucking hate carrots. Fucking carrots! I can't fucking stand them. They're bastards! They're just fucking carrots! You know, it's because, you know, Jeremy showed up to people that they were journalists. Yeah, it was a mirror that they were bought and paid for, showed them up, and they can't. People will do anything to avoid looking in that mirror, to seeing themselves as they truly are. They will drink themselves stupid. They will do whatever they can to avoid
that. We have the least trusted media in Europe.
Yeah. Can I give them an exclusive? Would you mind if
no,
I...
No,
go right ahead. I don't know what it is, but
so
go ahead.
Two of the most hated men, and you know, the most terrifying men in Britain, Len McCluskey and Jeremy Corbyn, will, with Melissa Benn hosting, on the 19th of October, do a poetry event in Liverpool.
What?
So, yeah, a poetry event, because underneath this, you know, so-called reputation is, you know, these complete bastards are two of the most humble and genuine and nice men that you could meet, and hopefully Melissa will bring this out. Using poetry, they'll express what they believe in and what provoked them to become engaged.
You've written poetry?
No, they're going to recite about poetry.
We're going to discuss the effect poetry have had on our lives. I have written poetry, but I'm not reading any of that. Listen, it's so bad. It's so bad.
It could not be related.
You know,
the only reason... 1992 TUC Congress.
The only possible reason to read it would be if the event is running over time, and the caretaking staff want us to get out of the building. Yeah. Like I say, Jeremy, come on, bring it on, read it out, and then you'll see the people filing out. No, we were going to be discussing what inspires us in our lives. And you see, socialism isn't just about the economy. It's not just about services. It's not just about structures. It's about people and their empowerment, and how it's the socialism of everyday life. Mm. And it's also the socialism of imagination.
Yeah, and that's
it's the artists, it's the poets, it's the musicians, it's the comedians. It's people that think outside the box and say things. Poets say truths because they can. Comedians say truths because they can. Artists express it in their own way, which is why I was so determined that we would have fixed, protected funds into every school for art and music education. Because that's what inspires the next generation.
And that's one of the things, like, Starmer talks about, what's the banal bullshit he's talking about today? Working hard. And I mean, hard working families. But when you spoke, you spoke about love, you spoke about the purpose of life. What's the, you know, rather than this dull fucking grind that you talked about.
Well, also, don't define everybody as a family.
Eh?
Don't define everybody as a family.
Yeah, well,
single people also work hard.
Yeah.
Well, if I don't want to work.
But it was also that you were, I think, trying to, you are trying to move towards, you know, to what the purpose of our existence is, not just a grind where you can buy another washing machine, but to live in a better world of love and understanding.
Ultimately, we've got to get into that world, and that means there has to be a public support for everyone's basic standard of living rather than an ever-growing economy that destroys the very planet on which we live.
Yeah.
Well, that is not going to happen tomorrow. It's a longer-term process. But socialism is about protecting and extending people's lives as well as the environment.
Yeah, because the other thing about capitalism, of course, it depends on a permanent sense of dissatisfaction, doesn't it? Because you have to be convinced the next pair of trainers that you buy is going to make you happy, and these ones, you know, and so the endless round of consumption depends on you being...
Yeah, you've got better quality trainers than your neighbour. I haven't seen your neighbour's trainers yet. Have you seen them?
He's a barrister. He doesn't really wear trainers. You don't want to see a QC in trainees.
Yeah, the 14,000-word essay mentions business roughly 40 times and mentions trade unions 3 times.
Yes.
I rest my case about the direction of the trade union movement.
Yeah. All right. We're done.
Alexei, thank you very, very much. Jeremy, it's such a pleasure to be here with you, and thanks for all that you do.
The wit and
the humour you bring to events, and I've been listening to you for so many years. The problem is you and I need to get to know each other better, because what happens is I go into a meeting when you're speaking, I'm up next to speaking, you're already leaving, or the other way around.
Yeah. It's like being comics on the circuit years ago. Yeah. Well, we will. This is a start of
a beautiful friendship.
Did you ever do the Red Rose Comedy Club?
No, I never did. No, because you financed that, didn't you, more or less?
Yeah, it was a great place.
I think I might have done years.
You probably went there once or twice. Yeah. Jeremy Hardy was very often there. He was very loyal supporter of the Red Rose Comedy Club.
Well,
I've got to thank Tommy for helping making this happen.
Tommy Corbyn, the Twitter in chief.
Who runs the National Hemp Service.
Yeah. He's a bloody riot on
his Shout out to him. Totally. I met him a couple of years ago at a gig. So man, I'm so grateful that he helped.
He rang me up and said, "Hey, Dad, I want something." I said, "Well, there's a change."
So that was Jeremy Corbyn doing the Alexis L podcast.
Yeah.
I don't know where we can go from there.
I know. Is this the last episode?
Yeah, we might give up after this. I think it was, I mean, Talal said it's Jeremy, like he's never seen him before already, relaxed.
Yeah, open. I was expecting him to be a bit more shielded.
Yeah, me too.
Holding back, but he seemed very candid and... you can't see it at home, but his body language was extremely relaxed.
Yeah.
And it kind of explains his appearances when he's being grilled by, you know, reporters on television. He kind of takes that posture too. He never seems that...
No, I think because they were always so hostile that he, you know, he kind of got... he would get defensive, I think. I think one of the interesting things and one of the, you know, I think that nobody else has got before is when he talks about what it is like to be in the middle of all that barrage of negativity and how that's a deliberate tactic in a way.
Under siege, yeah.
I think he talked about that. And, you know, if you get some shithead like... You know, WeBuyAnyCar.com, Phil, what's the shithead called?
Schofield.
Philip Schofield, you know, shouting at your fucking Jon Snow, you know, will you apologise for a completely made-up story? Mm. How can you apologise for a made-up story? Well, when people are yelling at you like that, it's difficult to, you know. You're under siege, you know, and so, you know, when he's...
I think lack of ego.
Yeah.
Because when he mentioned how, because this isn't stress, and then he told us what real stress is, like, you can't argue with that. But then also, like, any sane human would be completely stressed under that.
He's too relaxed. And I think compare that with fucking Starmer. Thin-skinned, ambitious little git. Anyway, that's the Alexis L podcast number 16. Quite a milestone in our podcasting history.
Shit.
Yeah.
I forgot to ask him about D&D.
D&D?
Dungeons and Dragons.
Ah. Yeah, so I was going to ask you about Dungeons and Dragons. Look, thank God you didn't.
Next
time, Alexis L, podcast number 17 will be Xi Jinping, the president of China, People's Republic of China.
I'll talk to his son.
Yeah. Tommy Xi Jinping. See you then. Bye.
You've been listening to the Alexis L podcast. This show is produced and edited by Talal Karkouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Thanks to Anthony Overton for the sound mixing. And to Audio Boom for hosting us. Please keep your emails coming in at alexislpodcast@gmail.com. Goodbye.